Blog Talk Radio.
I have a question for you. You know who your politicians are. Everything is political in your life. From the moment you're born to the moment you die, and when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. And we're going to be discussing all those things that those politicians have done for you and to you. Just because you've been a Democrat or a Republican your entire life, maybe you were wrong, because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there that are working for your benefit, and we're going to bring them to you right here on The Last Word. I'm Michael Lawson. Yes, sir, it's 3 p.m., well, just a little bit after that now. I'm Michael Lawson, and this is The Last Word, operating from the frozen west. Well, I should say the frozen east, East Charlotte. And Thomas Fortenberry will be calling in because the kids are off today for the third day in a row. My wife just got out of here a few minutes ago. Well, she said about 3 hours ago. They let her in to work late. They let them come in late. I have one of my grandkids here. But we're going to be operating like we're in the frozen Arctic, because I'm looking outside on my deck. We had 9 inches of snow here. I measured it out of my deck yesterday. It was 9 inches. So, but you know what? That does not stop the nut jobs. The nut jobs. They're finally catching up to some of these criminals out there. Like Chris Christie and those that old knucklehead down there in Florida with the bald head who stole over $1 billion from the Medicare system. Should be in jail. The governor. But we have one right here that's going to be in deep doo-doo. A man who's solely owned and bought by Art Pope and Duke Power. Duke Power first, because they own it for 28 years. And now Art Pope. But they're sharing them up there. You know, they're like they were in prison. They're sharing their little pretty boy. It seems like Duke Power dumped some stuff into the two different rivers here in North Carolina against, in violation of the Clean Water Act. Well, you know what? Let me let Rachel Maddow explain to you what actually went on. I mean, this is a little cut of her show last night.
Thank you at home for joining us this hour. Happy snow day. The administration of Republican North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory has just been subpoenaed in conjunction with a federal criminal investigation. Now, this is not New Jersey. This is a whole different governor. But the language is starting to feel familiar by now. You are commanded to appear in this federal court. You are commanded to bring with you the following documents. It's not clear yet who exactly is being investigated and for what potential crime. But the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of North Carolina, the federal prosecutor in North Carolina, is making the general terms of this thing very clear. Quote, an official criminal investigation of a suspected felony is being conducted by an agency of the United States and a federal grand jury.
Hey, well, maybe they could share a cell together. It'd be nice. The only thing is that, Chrisley was a wrestler in school, and they might be wrestling over the money. Over not sure the money. A little slip of the tongue. Wrestling over the food. Chrisley will probably be busting those staples that he had in him. Let me read a little bit to you about this. North Carolina regulators. These guys, which are owned by Duke Power. That's right, the regulators in North Carolina are owned by Duke Power. We're going to get into a little bit of that later, but here's what happened. This was yesterday. Federal authorities have launched a criminal investigation into a massive coal ash spill into the North Carolina River, demanding that Duke Energy and state regulators hand over reams of documents related to the accident that left a waterway polluted with tons of toxic sludge. Tons of toxic sludge. That's right. Tons. And they were told not to put this coal ash sludge by any waterways. They were told this. And he said an official criminal investigation of the suspected felony is being conducted by an agency of the United States and a federal grand jury. This was in the cover letter, accompanying a subpoena, which was dated this Monday, by a criminal prosecutor. Okay? Now, it also says the exact crime and precisely who is being targeted for potential prosecution is not spelled out in the document because they're going to get everybody. A Duke spokesman confirmed that the nation's largest electricity provider had also received a subpoena. Okay. Thomas Walker, the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of North Carolina, said he could not comment on the subpoena. The spill at the Duke power plant at Eaton spewed enough toxic sludge to fill 73 Olympic-sized swimming pools. And if you saw the pictures last night on TRM, you would have saw it was green. The river was green. People fish in this river. It further says that turning the river water a milky gray for miles was the third largest coal ash spill in U.S. history. State officials have advised the people to do not eat fish from this river, to avoid contact with water. The coal ash contains arsenic, lead, mercury, and a host of other chemicals that are highly toxic to humans and fish life, any life, aquatic life. In addition to the demand for records, prosecutors also ordered the State Environmental Agency chief lawyer to testify next month before a grand jury. Agency spokesman Drew Elliott said the state will fully cooperate with the federal investigation. Now the cover-up begins. In addition to the demands for records, prosecutors also ordered the state, Duke Energy spokesman Thomas Williams said the company doesn't comment on pending litigation. The subpoena was issued the day after the Associated Press reported that environmental groups have tried three times in the past year to sue under the Clean Water Act to force Duke to clear out leaky coal ash dumps. Each time, the state agency blocked the citizens' lawsuit by intervening at the last minute to assert its own authority under the act to take enforcement action in the state. So what they did was individuals sued for this, which you can do under the Clean Water Act. But the state authority stepped in and said, no, don't worry about it, people. We're here now. The big boys are in town. We'll make them pay. Yeah, they made Duke Power pay $99,000. Art Pope has that in his pocket. He spends that for lunch. And the chairman of Duke Power spends it for breakfast. After negotiating with Duke's lawyers in private, the state officials proposed settlements that environmentalists regarded as highly favorable to the company. Duke, a company valued at more than $50 billion, would have paid fines of $99,000 for groundwater pollution, which is what they did. The settlement would have required Duke to study how to stop contamination, but it also included no requirements to clean up the dumps near Asheville and Charlotte, where I live. That's why I have a filter, and I'm getting it updated to a new filtration system. See, when that moron, McCrory and Pope, when they weren't in charge of this whole state, it was all right. We had him down here in Charlotte for 12 years, wherever it was, McCrory. But he wasn't running the city. Cannon was running the city. The city council runs the city of Charlotte, not McCrory. So there's nothing that McCrory could say, I did this. He didn't do jack. Among the documents targeted by the federal subpoenas are the correspondence between Duke and the state environmental agency related to proposed deals highlighted in the AP story. On Monday, lawyers for the state asked a judge to disregard the agency's own proposed settlement in the wake of the spill. See, they said, well, we got something how to fix this. Nay, no more. They can't. They're no longer involved. The Clean Water advocates how long have long complained that the state regulators are too cozy with the polluters they regulate. And this is the case. Pat McCrory, a pro-business Republican who worked for Duke Power 28 years, shows he has benefited from the $1.1 million in political donations linked to his former employer since 2008. Oh, you mean just because he, you know, when I first moved down here, and see, this is the problem here. This state is so lax. They have nobody works full time in the state. Nobody works full time in the state or the city or in the county. They're all part time jobs. They don't get paid as much as a daggone person in McDonald's in New York, about $13,000. That's what they get paid. So, I mean, who cares what they do? It's like Mayberry on steroids. So if he is getting paid, McCrory worked for Duke Power for 28 years and has a pension that's probably 10 times what Duke Power paid in fines so far. They could pay $99,000 every other day, and it would not put a dent in their assets. So what are we talking about here? Southern Environmental Law Center, the group that has tried to sue Duke under the Clean Water Act, okay, also filed enforcement action for all three Duke's remaining coal ash sites in North Carolina, effectively blocking environmentalists from pursuing further action under the Federal Act. I mean, this is unbelievable. It's really, Harleman said he hopes prosecutors press state regulators on why they did not take tougher action. If anything proves that this is a very serious situation, this subpoena and the grand jury do. If this doesn't get Duke's attention, and if it doesn't get the DENR's attention, now who's the DENR? I have no idea. Well, it has to be. I have no idea. What will? Weiss reported to the Greenville, South Carolina. Now, further on this, because we're going to be talking about this probably for the next couple of weeks, North Carolina regulators, this is where we're going to go into a little bit about how they shielded themselves from the environmentalists against being fined and sued for the Clean Water Act coal ash violations. Over the last year, environmentalist groups have tried three times to use the Federal Clean Water Act to force Duke Energy to clear our outleaky coal ash, like the one that ruptured last week, spewing 73-size Olympic swimming pools, okay, full of coal ash. Each time they said their efforts have been stymied. This is coming out of AP, Associated Press. Okay, the state agency has blocked the citizens' lawsuits by intervening at the last minute to assert its own authority under the Federal Act to take enforcement action. After negotiating with Duke, the state proposed settlements where the nation's largest electricity provider paid modest fines but is under no requirement to clean up their act. Clean water activists have long complained that state regulators are too cozy with the polluters. Okay, Pat McCrory is also a Republican who also worked for Duke Power 28 years, as we said before. McCrory said, my administration is the first in North Carolina's history to take legal action against the utility regarding coal ash ponds. That remains to be seen. We never had a coal ash spill in North Carolina before. You also have to remember that the Democratic Party ran North Carolina for the last century. This is the first time, and that's because, hey, that's what happens when you don't get out and vote. You turn it over to the freaking daggone nut jobs. He further said, we have been moving on this issue since the beginning of my term and will continue to do so. Not, environmentalists suggest, his administration's real goal has been to shield the governor's former employer from far more severe expensive penalties it might face if the cause ever made it to the federal courtroom. Duh, you think? Amy Adams was a regional director at the State Environmental Agency in charge of enforcing surface water standards for 21 North Carolina counties before she resigned in protest last November. A 9-year veteran of the agency, she said she was directed in her last month to help polluters meet compliance standards rather than issue violations or fines. This is what she said. We have a governor right now that is very close ties to Duke, the state's largest polluter, and a major political contributor to his campaign. This is what Adam said. Who now works for the environmental group Appalachian Voices? Under the new administration, North Carolina has changed the definition of whom its customer is from the public and the natural resources it's supposed to protect to the industry it regulates. There's been a huge push away from environmental protection and towards promoting economic growth. Since his unsuccessful campaign for governor in 2008, campaign finance reports show Duke Energy, its political action committee, executives, and their immediate families have donated at least $1.1 million to McCrory's campaign, affiliated groups, and spent, which included TV ads, mailings, and other things. After winning the 2012 election, McCrory has appointed former Duke employees like himself to keep posts, including State Commissioner, Commerce Secretary Shannon Decker. His appointee to overcome the State Environmental Department, Raleigh businessman John Scavalli, I believe that's his name, described his agency's role as being a partner to those it regulates, whom he refers to as the customers. The Duke Power is now the customers, not the people who live in the state. That's why we have been able to turn DENR, that's what that is again, what the heck is DENR, which we don't know, which we're trying to find out for North Carolina, number one obstacle of resistance into customer-friendly juggernaut in such a short time. Scavalla wrote in a letter to the editor of the News and Observer in Raleigh, people in the private sector pour their hearts and soul into their work. Instead of crushing their dreams, they now have a state government that treats them as partners. Can you believe this load? This is what they think of all of you in the state. This is what they think of all of you. The public was not told about the breach until the following day. And initial reports provided by Duke did not make clear the massive scale of the disaster. McCrory made no public comments on the issue for 5 days after the spill had gone downstream and gotten national. Environmental groups and federal regulators have been concerned for years about the problem at Duke's 31 coal waste pods in North Carolina. Those concerns intensified after a 2008 disaster in Kingston, Tennessee, where 5 million cubic yards of ash burst out of a basin covering 300 acres and devastating a nearby river. The cleanup has cost $1.2 billion so far, and it's not been cleaned up since 2008. After Kingston, the Southern Environmental Law Center began examining conservatives groups and, or conservationist groups and targeted a coal ash lagoon along the Wartree River in South Carolina. On behalf of the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation, the legal group filed a lawsuit against the Southern Carolina Electric and Gas for violating state environmental laws. They reached an agreement about requirements and the utility to empty its lagoon and remove the ash to a landfill licensed to handle the hazardous material. So we're going to hear more and more about this as we go on. But this is just completely unbelievable. But should I say it's unbelievable? Should I actually say that this is unbelievable? No, it's not. I think we are now, we're in a position right now, and as I said on my, and I'm going to read this a couple of times during the show, there's a old saying, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. Just keep that in mind as this show goes on today. I'm going to say it again and again during the show. Every time we come into a target that you see and hear is not what you thought it was. Just like this coal ash bill. They don't care. It's about the money. How much power can you grab? And let the chips fall where they may. It's as simple as that. Now, we need to make sure that we, the people who vote, need to understand that we're here in this state, North Carolina, and I'm talking to people who live in North Carolina now. You, for 125 years, this state was either second or third in education. They had going on the best area to have environmental cleanups. We never had anything like this. You can look to North Carolina, and as I said, I tell everybody, you're driving down the highway, and you know damn well when you have gone into South Carolina. You know it automatically. Everything turns brown. That's because they don't give a damn down in South Carolina. The people don't vote. They've never been in control of their environment. They have never been in control of the legislature. So they have never seen the other side of the horizon. We here in North Carolina have always seen the rainbow at the end. We have been in that rainbow. We have made these schools, as I said, the top two or three in the country. And since this governor and Art Pope, who is the actual governor, have taken over this government. Since they have taken over, we have now dropped from 2010 to from second or third to behind Mississippi in education of our kids. We're now on par with West Virginia in environmentally controlling our water, breathable air. So don't talk about, I'm glad I'm not in West Virginia. You're getting it here. Charlotte is a city in the largest, next, probably Wake County says they're larger, but we're the largest city in the state of North Carolina, probably the 17th largest city or 15th in the country. And we're heading towards a major environmental disaster. We've already had three. This last one was the, as far as I'm concerned, the tipping point. So whatever you read, make sure you stay on top of this subject. No matter if you're in England, South Korea, Wyoming, North Carolina, New York City, say something. Say something. If you want to say something, you can call here at 646-716-5242 and voice your opinion, 646-716-5242. All right, we're going to be having my lecture for today, and I was hoping that my senior producer, Thomas Fortner, will be calling in. I'm expecting him to call in. We're going to have a great show for you today. I met a gentleman who's going to be on the show later. His name is William Cunningham. And will you hear what this guy has for you? I'm telling you, it's amazing. And I didn't realize how simple some things are. But things are simple when you're able to explain them to a person that, to anybody. And what I want everyone to do is to listen up. We're going to have Matt Newton, who is the major lawyer here in Mecklenburg County, who helped help rewrite the CRB, the Civilian Review Board, and how they act in case of police shootings or other things like that. He's running for candidate for state senator, District 40, which is the seat that Malcolm Graham is vacating to run for District 12 at the U.S. House. Now, watch seat. We're also going to have Joyce Wardell, who's a member of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community School Board, I'm sorry, and she should be calling in shortly. She's also running for North Carolina State Senate District 40 seat. We're also going to have Randy Vola, who is the chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party. He's going to be on, and of course we'll have Grace on, who is the chair of the 8th Congressional District in North Carolina. And we're going to be having, during the last hour, David Adams, who is a fascinating individual who has a blog called peopleschampion.me. And he has been doing a yeoman's job for a young man named Shannon, and I hope I pronounce his name right, Shannon Namadi, who's been in jail without charges. Now, he's not in Guantanamo. He's in jail in the United States without charges for over a year. His birthday was just this past, I think it was Lincoln's birthday, February 12th. I think he either turned 18 or 19. But we're going to have him on, and we're also going to have his mother, Shannon. She will be on. Shannon is his name. Elizabeth. I'm sorry, Elizabeth. Elizabeth will be on. And we're going to talk about getting him out. This man does not need to be in prison. He has done nothing whatsoever. But, so that's the show. It's a big show today. But hey, let's listen to what the nut jobs Rush Limbaugh has said about the Rush Limbaugh, who's the, and is it, Charles Krauthammer. Krauthammer. You know Charles Krauthammer. Krauthammer is on the Fox News. These people cannot stand Obama. They can't stand him. They said he's stealing. He's not enforcing the laws. Well, just listen to him for a minute here.
This law of the land doesn't even exist. It exists in Obama's head. It's whatever he thinks. He wakes up in the morning and decides what the law is going to be. That, as an understatement, that's not the way it's supposed to work.
Now, what the hell is this man talking about? Obama just thinks up laws. The only one that, you know, and I keep telling my senior producer, Thomas, we need to do a show on the Constitution and how a bill becomes a law. We're going to do that, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm hoping to have that by the first or second week in March. But the Constitution has nothing to do with anything that the president has done. See, they're trying to say now that executive orders to Constitution. That's nonsense. Executive orders have been part of the Constitution for as long as anybody can think. Executive orders are given to the President of the United States. See, because when a law, when a bill becomes a law, the president is the one who enforces the law. But there are people who don't want the president to do anything. They want him to be a nothing. They don't want him to have a legacy of ever doing anything. Because that would mean that this man, this black man, did a better job than their last man that they had in this country. You know what? If you look at how executive orders had passed per day in office, do you know who issued more executive orders than any president ever? FDR. And by the way, he was elected. He was president for 16 years. And then you have George W. Bush. He didn't, compared to Hoover, Wilson, Harding, Coolidge, Taft, Teddy Roosevelt, Truman, Carter, Kennedy, Ford, Johnson, Nixon, Eisenhower, Reagan. Reagan issued more executive orders than Bush and Obama and Daddy Bush and Clinton. So why is it that this man can come into the White House? He's not allowed to do the same exact thing that other people have done. I mean, am I missing something here? Why can't he do it? Why can't this man do the same exact thing that other people have done for years? The president can't write a law. So he said, oh, the president is breaking the law. No, the president gets a law from or delivered to his desk from, I believe it's the speaker's people that sent him the law. I have to look that up. I'm not sure. Since I'm solo here, I can't do that. But the law is delivered to him. The president, you know, they'll set up a time where it's midnight. No matter what it is, he will sign it if it's important. He will get up from his bed or put his cocktail down and come over and sign the law. Now, the moment he signs that law, it is now the privy of the President of the United States, the entire executive branch that he is the president of. The right-wing morons in the legislature no longer have control of this bill. because it's the executive branch that enforces the law, not the legislature. They write it. The executive branch enforces it. That means when Eisenhower told those people in Alabama and Georgia that, hey, they had to integrate or we're sending in federal troops, they needed to integrate or he was going to send in federal troops. It is not the privy of a state government or the legislature or any other persons within those branches or any other branch to stop or to prevent the will of the executive board. The executive board is actually the executive branch of government, of our three branches of government, the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch. Now, when the legislative branch has a problem with a law, they take it to the judicial branch. But they only take it there if they think it's a big enough issue that they might get a safe ruling on. That's why it's so important for us to elect judges like Supreme Court Judge Sherry Berry. Sherry Beasley here in North Carolina. She's running again for the Supreme Court. Also, Mr. Jim, my grandson Hayden Presley, Jim Irvin, who will be on the show, I believe, next week. So, who's the related to Sam Irvin, if everybody remembers. But the executive branch gets the law and the president signs it. Now it's up to him to enforce the law. That's why Eisenhower said, I'm sending in federal troops if you don't do this. You remember that nitwit who stood in the schoolhouse door and wouldn't let those African-American kids come to school? Mr. Wallace, who was governor, George Wallace, the president enforced the law. Legislature can't enforce the law. Can't make people do it, but the president can. He can also say, I ain't going to enforce it. And George Wallace would have been a nobody. Nobody ever would have heard of him, because he would never have stood in the door to prevent black kids from entering a high school. So this is enforcement of the law. When the legislature sends the president a law, he now can decide when to make it work and enforce it and when not to make it work. He can slow it down. He can say, look, we're not going to enforce this portion of the law until I see other things half times. You just can't shove an apple down a horse's throat. You have to let them nibble on it if they want it. So that's what we're looking at here. The President of the United States took the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, otherwise known as Obamacare, and chose not to enforce some of the regulations with business. Now, you would think this would be a major coup for Republicans. But you see, the Republicans are no longer there. As I said, it's better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. I said I was going to say that a couple of times during the show. And that's what it's all about. These would rather see the destruction of their own party than to help the President of the United States. Now, why is that? Okay, we'll get back to that. We'll just get back to that. We have a major problem that's going to be developing here in North Carolina if these people, Macquarie and his crew, do not help the citizens of this great state vote before we leave the people in this country voting, before we leave the subject of lawlessness. Let's hear what the father of the Republican Party is saying about Obama's lawlessness.
What do we do to stop somebody as lawless? Some president is lawlessness. What do we do? Nobody knows. Nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows how to stop him giving away money. Nobody knows how to beat him giving away money. Nobody knows how to deal with a guy who makes up the law every day as he gets up. We've never dealt with it, so nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows what to go on TV and say. Nobody knows what kind of policy to author. Nobody knows about a lawsuit. Well, who's got standing? Who do we sue and on what basis? Nobody knows what to do.
Nobody knows what to do. This is their answer to everything now. Oh, my God. You know, if Rush doesn't know what we should do, I mean, who the hell else can we go to? Has it been that bad that we no longer can think of what to do? I mean, you know, it's just impossible. Drive me crazy. I mean, Ashley said that. He's making up laws every day. But you notice one thing? They have never, ever said what law he's violating. Let's see what our caller says here. Hello, caller.
Hello, sir.
Oh, it's you. It's Thomas Fortenberry.
How are you?
Well?
I have been stuck in snowpocalypse.
Snow apocalypse? Well, you know, our favorite, my favorite neighbor next door, we've been feeding him every night. You know, because you know, he didn't get up to 1 o'clock in the morning. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon every day, 1:30.
Well, you know, it's
he
it's
did
good
not
to,
know it was snowing. He did not know it was snowing.
Out.
Almost like the George, like Governor McCrory and the governor in Alabama didn't know it was going to snow. Didn't know it was going to be that bad. I said, well,
and like those,
said, well,
those
I'll
poor
just
people
drive
in,
up now. What?
Yeah, those poor people in Georgia had no idea.
Well, no, yeah, but see, the problem is that, Atlanta, yeah, what you're talking about is absolutely true. But the problem is there, they sent everybody home at once. See, that's
right.
But my neighbor, Ned, who is a fabulous guy, if you like, neighbor's name, Ned. But anyway, Ned.
Well, I enjoy the Greco-Roman pool, you know.
Yes, he does have that Olympic ice swimming pool. But so I spoke to him. This is the day it started snowing, which was now seems like a year ago, but it was 3 days ago. He said, he called me. He says, Mike, there's snow out there. I said, yeah, Ned, it's been snowing for 5 hours. I had just come in from the food line, the grocery store, because and I was the last one in, because they were closing up. They said, we got to get everybody out of here by 2:30. So I went and got a couple of things. I said, oh, I'm going to make some beef stew and et cetera, et cetera. And so I got the stuff made for it and came back in just in time. I measured the snow then on my deck. It was 5.5 inches. So I said, And they said it was only like 3 inches at the airport. So I don't know what airport they were in, but it was 5.5 inches on my deck. And my deck is flat. So...
Yeah,
well,
that was like me. I was walking
that.
Around out here, and it was over my boots, and they kept saying, you know, 3 to 6 inches, and I'm like, I think we're already over six there, Captain.
Yes. So the thing is that he said, well, you think I said, no, Ned, you can't get out. With my car, big car, it slid from your house, and I had to make that turn, and it stopped sliding just as I got into, made the turn to go in my driveway. I said, so forget it. You ain't getting back up the hill. Nobody's getting up this hill. So he said, my God.
There's also that slight problem, though. Where would you go? There's nothing open.
Yeah, I said, and nothing is open. He said, no place. McDonald's is even closing. I said, Ned, he said, don't you have, no, of course. That was a rhetorical question I asked him. Don't you have food in the refrigerator? He says, no, I have a couple of peanut butter cookies. I said, that's nice that he got in a church something or other Sunday. Okay, when the refrigerator is still fresh then. I said, Ned, I'm making some beef stew. If you can make it over here, you can make it. He said, oh, yeah, let me get my boots. Now, here's a guy that's got more money than I don't know who. He's got more money. Anyway, the thing is, he doesn't go out to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I say dinner, the last meal of the day, till 9 o'clock at night. His breakfast is like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So, you know, my back door, I opened up the back door, just had the glass and look at the nice snow. And about 10 o'clock, he's knocking on my door. I see him because the light came on. No boots. It's up to, it must be up 10 inches over his sneakers. I said, Ned, I opened the door. Well, what are you coming out of here? No boots. What's going on? You crazy? I couldn't find them, but I was getting hungry. He said, okay. Come on in, Ned. We had a McJulep. We had some wine. We had the beef stew. I said, Ned. He said, Mike, what am I going to do? I said, well, there's always tomorrow is another day. We'll have some more beef stew left. I made enough in the crock pot for a week.
But nice.
So was the other part. So I said, I knew this was going to happen. I haven't had beef stew in about 2 years. I mean, it was beautiful. Sliced steak. It was unbelievable. Anyway, last night, same thing. He said, Mike, you have any beef stew? I said, yes, and my wife made cornbread. He said, well, I don't eat the cornbread because I don't want to get fat. I said, oh, yeah, if you know the potatoes and the rice in there, you ain't going to get fat. All right. I said, well, it's ready. It's ready, Ned. We came over. He had some more. And I need to tell you when I see you offline, what a conversation. But anyway, The thing is, so how could people not get ready for this? How could they not be ready? Well, it's just like the callers, the two people who were running for office were supposed to call, heard nothing from them. They're not
going
to get picked up because we got a full schedule here. But did you, I don't know if you heard the part where I read about that McCrory and the Pope administration of North Carolina has now have federal subpoenas. And I texted that last night, right?
I woke up to that news this week. That was quite a shocker, simply because we knew that the McCrory, or McCrony administration was doing everything possible to, help and protect Duke power. I mean, the first act he did when he went in there, you remember the very first day, is he dissolved all the panels and investigative committees. You remember he got in trouble for doing that, but that was what they started with. So we knew this was happening, but I was surprised at how fast the federal government moved on this because they usually are playing catch-up.
That's right. This is really a major, quite a quick move. This is really quite a quick move.
It is. I mean, you're talking a matter of days, and they're already hitting the ground running with subpoenas and setting up a grand jury. So that's pretty amazing. But I think the reason why is not only because there's clear evidence that they've been covering up and they misreported it and didn't, allow lawsuits to go forward. But on top of that, we've had, you're talking about being prepared, with the snow. Well, we've already gone through, we've got about 40% of the water in West Virginia undrinkable now. So when we just have this bill, which, you know, they keep playing with the figures for, but 82,000 tons of coal ash, 27 million gallons of contaminated water. They spill. It's already been rated one of the, I think, what, third largest spills ever?
Third largest.
But they, you know, when this happens, I think they had to jump on it because of what's happened before. You know, we've already seen the disasters in West Virginia and how, I mean, that company, Freedom Works, or whatever they call themselves, are changing their names and bankrupting themselves and everything else so that they can't be sued into the ground. So that's why I think they're jumping so quickly on this, because you see already the same pattern of behavior where the state is blocking investigations, where they're not reporting on time, they're not reporting the amounts, you know, correctly, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that I'm looking at is I just don't understand. I did read it on a blog that they were caught unaware also, and this is going to be a major problem with them. And what we need to do now is to make sure that they do not get off the hook. This
right.
is only going to mean. People, what do you do in North Carolina? They want to hunt and fish. What do the things they're hunting do? They drink out of the rivers. What are they going
right.
to do? They're going to drop dead from the coal ash
yep.
spill. What the fish going
oh,
to do?
You're
they're
talking
all
about, you know,
float to the top.
Yep. You're going to have mercury poisoning. You're going to have, you know, two-headed fish or whatever. You know, it's going to be a disaster.
Well,
besides the fact
that is, yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, besides the fact you can't even drink the water. I mean, that's the major deal, you know, and that's what happened in West Virginia. They had no fresh drinking water for anyone. They had to truck in, you know, millions of liters of water. So we're running, you know, potentially into that problem here. You've already got this entire river system that's contaminated, and if it is more extensive or gets into the city water supplies, you're going to end up with a lot of communities unable to drink anything. So,
oh yeah, well, see now here on this it said on January 2013, the SELC filed a notice of intent to sue Duke in federal court over coal ash pollution at the company's Asheville steam generating plant. The Coal Water Act allows citizens to file a group over environmental violations, but it requires them to give 60 days notice to the state regulators so they can take action in case and proceed, okay? On the 58th day, the 58th day after the notice was filed, it was asserted DENR filed the notice. It was assessed that they now had jurisdiction, the state. On March 26th, the SCLC sent another notice of contamination for coal ash in the lagoons of River Bend Steam Station in Gaston County. On the 60th day, state regulators again intervened. On June 19th, the legal group once again sent a 60-day notice to sue Duke over coal ash pollution leaking from Duke's Sutton power plant near Wilmington.
Right.
The Sutton site is a – this guy said, Frank Holloman, is scary. He's a senior attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center. They've got significant groundwater contamination on one side headed towards the drinking water wells of a poor community. On the other side, you have a popular public fishing lake where they had significant fish die and fish contamination. Once again, state regulators filed an enforcement action against Duke on the very last day. This time, however, the state also filed enforcement action for all of Duke's remaining coal ash sites in North Carolina, which effectively blocks environmentalists from pursuing action against them under the Clean Water Act. Okay?
Yep.
Meanwhile, the state announced a deal with Duke to settle the litigation involving the Asheville and Riverhead River Bend sites. $99,000. Now, Art Pope walks around with $99,000 in his back pocket.
Yeah.
Let alone
they were talking.
Power. Good.
They were talking last night on the news that that amount of fine equals about one-tenth of what Duke gave to the governor's campaign just in ad money alone.
That's correct. That's correct. And
so, I mean, you're talking again about literally about pocket change.
Absolutely. Let me see. The pocket change that we have.
But here's the thing that's the most damning about it. It isn't the fact that they charged them a few dollars. They've done two things. One, the state stepped in and took over the lawsuits, so it ends all the environmental groups' participation, and they're the sole broker with the company, which is Duke. And they have reached settlements without any public involvement, oversight, transparency, nothing. They just announce what they settled. And the settlements, though they had the slap on the wrist fine, had no requirements to stop polluting, to clean up polluting, or to in any way fix the damages of what they've done.
Right.
So it was just a continue on, same old, and don't even clean up the spills that already exist.
I mean, they could pay these fines every single day. Every day they could pay these fines. Every single day they could pay these fines. And it would mean nothing. It would actually mean nothing to them. And the problem we have is because now they have a man who's watching over their shoulder. They got a man who's watching them, who can help them with any case that they have. This is where we're at today. And this is why if we don't do something about this, we are going to be in major trouble. We're going to be in major trouble.
Right.
I mean, because there's nothing else that can be done but what we're doing. Nothing.
Right.
And the people who are pursuing this have the way to pursue it, but they can't pursue it because the Bush, the McCrory administration and the Art Pope administration are always standing in the way. They have now blocked every single thing that can be done. Everything that can be done. And we're now in the middle of a... Go ahead.
Oh, no, I just... last night I heard on one of the channels on TV that they not only were blocking the initial damage, but one of the reasons the federal government stepped in is that they blocked environmental groups and all from any lawsuits at all and any investigation of any of the, 300 coal ash retaining things that they have, these little reservoirs they have all over the state that this one spilled. But they have them everywhere, and they're supposedly all leaking.
We have with us right now, our doctor is in the house.
I'm on the phone, Jim.
We have our doctor in the house, Miss Grace Lee Galloway. Hello, doctor. Hello,
good
doctor.
Afternoon.
How are you?
I am great. Good afternoon, Michael. So good to be on.
And, were you listening a little bit to our
Yes.
Let me tell you what I did
was, and when you're talking about pocket change, I immediately went to my pocket to find out how much change that I had. I had a total of $1.21. Now that's my pocket change, okay?
Yeah.
Let's talk about Duke Power's pocket change. I mean, seriously, my pocket change might buy you a cup of coffee, but Duke's pocket change could mean wages.
$5,000.
Yeah. I mean, how many jobs are we talking about, right?
That's right.
So,
well, see, here's the thing
now.
I want to know, I haven't heard it yet, but have you heard that they're blaming this coal ash bill on the ACA, the Affordable Care Act?
No. It's not his. It's not their political character. It's Obama. Yeah, and Clinton.
Oh, it's Obama. Yeah.
It's Obama's fault. It's
yeah.
Clinton's fault. Right. Uh-huh. Let's blame it on Clinton. I mean, what the hey? He's, you know. Yeah. So, come on.
We have also with us, Chairman of the Democratic Party, North Carolina, Mr. Randy Bowler. How are you, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, are you there? Randy? Nope, I guess he's not there.
Perhaps not.
Anyway, what we're going to do.
Speaking of spare change, Mike,
yes,
I was just looking up Duke Energy's pay. You know the CEO of Duke Energy makes over $8 million a year?
Oh, well, I'm sure he
and
has
that. That's just the one executive, just for an example.
I'm sure he could put that in his pocket.
Yeah.
I'm sure
and of course,
he could put that.
Of course, the latest is that the 1% are up there now conducting their own campaign about how poor 1%ers, we are just picking on them so much. And
it's just
terrible. Why are we picking on them? And then the latest one also is that the rich should have more than one vote. You've heard that one, right?
Yes. Well,
the rich should have more than one vote.
Are you saying that they shouldn't? Is that what you're saying?
Hell yeah.
Because aren't they the job creators?
Really?
Aren't they the job?
The sarcasm, your voice is just dripping with sarcasm, my friend.
Yeah.
Nah. Yes, you sarcastic never.
These people are these poor 1% and half a 1%. Who is the gentleman that bought the, was it the Chicago?
Zell.
Tribune?
Zell. Yeah, Zell. And he bankrupted it within a year. And by the way, he bought it with other people's money, not even his own.
Of course. Well, why would you buy something with your own money? No, give me a break.
Yeah, especially when you can con someone else into, right. Especially when you can con someone else into, and taking the monetary risk and taking all the all of it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why should you do that? And what he has done is an example of how to stay rich?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Of course it is. You use somebody else's. You don't spend anything, but then he gets up there and he talks about being a job creator. I think he was a job destroyer because he managed to bankrupt the Chicago Tribune, and therefore destroyed not only all the not just the reporters. You know, how about the people who work in the mailroom? How about the people who operate the phones? How about the people who just the secretaries who answer the mail. How about all of those people? He essentially destroyed all their jobs. So as far as I'm concerned, for him to have the nerve to get out there and say he's a job creator, he really, liar, liar, pants on fire. Pants on fire. Seriously.
Well, I think when you destroy jobs at a newspaper for the very wealthy corporations, isn't that called a win-win?
It certainly is a win-win.
Yes, that's a win-win.
Again,
that's right.
the written press, like the Chicago Trib, they really are our last wall between the propaganda of the right-wing nut jobs and the extremely wealthy 1%, and getting the truth out. That's the difference. I mean, I look at the stuff on Facebook where people take one story, one source, and it becomes true. And I say, when I post and I try to bring in, inject some logic, some common sense, who gets, I'm the one that gets attacked. Okay? I'm the one that gets attacked for being an apologist for fill in the blank. So fill in the blank.
Right.
It could be anybody, right? It could be anyone. It could be Obama. It could be anyone. It could be Dr. Chavis, for example. And so I'm accused of being a Ben Chavis apologist. And my response is actually no. All I do is I'm reciting facts. Okay, that's the difference. I recite the facts, and I recite and I post what I found, not to be an apologist, not to be, you know, to stand up and say, this one is completely right or that one is completely right. I post in order to give, present all of the information to people so that they can read and make up their own mind. That's what I do. And I think that's very important to remember. We don't do that anymore today. And so when you have people like Zelt, sorry, go ahead.
Well, why would you want people to make up their own mind? Aren't we supposed to make up their minds for them?
Yes, I forget. I'm sorry, Michael. Mike, I am so sorry. I forgot that.
Listen,
it just reminds me.
I was speaking to my next door neighbor who is Ned, who I talk about. Ned is, he is so nice. He Unitracked, works for IBM for 150 years. He leaves any time of the day or night. Any time of the day or night, you go outside, and he'll have his speaker in his on his back deck playing WBT, which is the local station down there, down here in Charlotte for all of everybody else listening. And they play nothing but right-wing posts and Rush Limbaugh, okay? He go into his house. He has a TV in every room. He only goes in certain rooms. He turns them on by remote control. He doesn't go into rooms himself. He lives by himself. He'll have Fox News on. That's all. He said, well, I just listen. It's just background music for me. So last night he was eating because he had no food in the house. Now, that is something that aren't you supposed to now have, make sure you have guns and food in the house enough for a week? I thought that was the mantra that they But anyway, he...
Only if you want to survive, Mike.
Oh, only if you want to survive. Okay, well... He came over to the liberal because he had to eat, and he was he. So I subjected him to an hour of Rachel Maddow and an hour of The Last Word with Vance O'Donnell. He says, "I never heard these things before." When they were talking about the coal ash bill, he never heard those things about Christie and the $3 billion that he stole from the federal government for not building the tunnel. He says, you know, they don't say that on Fox. I said, really? Oh, my God.
Gee, I'm shocked.
Because they don't get news on Fox.
No.
They get no news.
But it's their news. It's like,
no, they don't get news. They get propaganda. That's the difference. There's no news.
Right. It's not news. I was going to say that what is on Fox is sheer unadulterated propaganda.
Yes, but you see, here's the thing. It's not propaganda only if you put a little truth in it. Because when it's all propaganda, that's not propaganda. When you just lie, completely lie, people finally catch up to you. So they have to weave a little bit of truth in it. Like, this is Friday, February 14th. That will be the truth. The rest of it would be like, you see, so the thing is that they have to, you cannot put straight lies out there. So they'll say, Obama is the president. And as Rush Limbaugh said, he's lawless. He's lawless. And then the quote, which you need to hear, Madam Chair, better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven.
And there you go.
This is what they are trying to do. Ted Cruz, this is what he wants to be. He wants to be the leader in hell, then serve in a good functioning Senate. When McConnell couldn't see the way to stop the bill for the deficit going through, he told the majority leader, Harry Reid, he said, look, we can't stop you, so we're going to go along with it because we know that this killed us the last time when we went off the rails in January for this debt. We'll go along. Just don't have it quiet. Don't announce the names at the desk. So Harry Reid said, no problem. But when Ted Cruz found out about it, he says, no, I'm going to have a filibuster if you do that. I want all the names read. So now the Republicans say, holy cow, because all they needed was five names from the Republican side, but the fifth person would go down in history as the Lucifer,
as being the
as
one,
the
right.
Judas.
Mm-hmm.
So who's it going to be? McConnell stood up. I give him that credit. He said, don't worry about it, gang. We'll make all the leaders, the five leaders, we're going to vote for the plan.
Hey, Mike.
They did.
Mike, you're confusing things.
Yes.
Because you're talking about Ted Cruz, and then you're talking about politicians. And they're two distinctly different things.
Because you forget
there are still some, you know, Republicans that are politicians. They're the old school politicians that happen to be on the other side of an issue, so they run the old way, and they're part of a party, and they participate in government, you know, things like that. Ted Cruz is literally his father, you know, the evangelical preacher, has raised him. He calls him the anointed one, and that's not hyperbole. Yeah, he's
preacher?
A right-wing preacher. He's an evangelical, you know, nut. But he calls him the anointed one, literally, and he says that God has selected Ted Cruz to lead this country, that he is destined to be the leader, and nothing can stand in his way, that he is chosen by God to be the leader of the world. So you're talking about two very different things. One's a politician, and one is somebody that, you know, may or may not be crazy, but definitely has a messiah complex because they've been raised that way.
They don't believe in politics. They're just chosen by God. So this is why I said, I quoted Milton, because his father is quoting Milton. Better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. They would rather have the Republican Party be reduced to ashes so they could then, with a stronger, more direct, little Republican Party with a little group of people following them. But this country cannot have that. Because this country
takes 12 followers, Mike. 12 followers. That's all you need.
Well, he's got 12. And I'm sure Nancy Rory would be one of them. You think so, Grace?
Yeah, probably.
I mean, she's already got her disciples down in Union County. So, this is really the extension that is going around the country. There's a 12% or maybe a 15% of knuckleheads, worshipers, who will follow this road.
Okay.
Now,
let's talk about knuckleheads.
Because I'm leading into that. We have the same thing in North Carolina. But we have the same thing in North Carolina.
Absolutely.
What do we have?
You're aware of the latest brouhaha regarding Dr. Ben Chavis, a respected civil rights.
The people who are listening, give them a short rundown.
I will give a short rundown. Dr. Ben Chavis is a North Carolina native son. Okay, he was part of the Wilmington 10. Was never pardoned. He should have been pardoned by Governor Hunt, but was never pardoned by Governor Hunt. Was ultimately pardoned by Governor Beth Perdue for his role. And by the way, Dr. Ben Chavis did serve time in jail for being, for his role in the Wilmington 10. Now, for all of you guys out there who are now able to ride in the front of the bus, for all of you guys out there who now can get a job or who have the freedoms to vote, for all of you guys, you need to thank people like Dr. Ben Chavis. You know, you need to thank people like Angela Davis, like Rosa Parks. And by the way, Angela Davis and Dr. Ben Chavis are very good friends. So all of y'all remember Angela Davis, the great activist?
Absolutely.
Right. So, yeah, a great activist. So for all of everyone right now within hearing distance of my voice, If you now have freedom as a minority, as a person of color, the person you need to thank, one of the persons you need to thank is Dr. Ben Chavis for standing up for us, for walking the distance and the miles that he walked on thorns and fire that he walked. And I am not, you know, you might think I'm exaggerating. You might call this rhetoric. I don't care what you call it. The reality of it is that he did. He put his life, he put his reputation, he put all of that on the line. Let's remember what the good that Dr. Ben Chavis did. Now, here's what happened. We had a situation in the Democratic Party where the executive director was let go. Now, let's remember also that the Section 4.10 of the Democratic Party Plan of Organization stipulates clearly that the ED serves at the pleasure of the chair. Now, if you are hired into a job and you serve at the pleasure of someone, don't you think you should work very closely with that someone? Yeah?
You mean he's not a dictator? Is he a
hell
dictator?
No. So if I was hired at the pleasure of your pleasure, right, Michael, it would make sense for me to say, okay, Michael, what do you want me to do? Okay, what is your game plan? Let's work together on this. And because I know that my job is contingent upon how you feel about me. The last thing I would do would be antagonize you. The last thing I would do would be to say, I am not going to follow your lead. I'm going to do whatever the heck I want. The last thing I would do would be to create other, you know, as much mess as possible. I would want to be as closely aligned as I possibly could with you. So having said that, you know, Dempsey was not the hero that so many people would like to make him out to be. I know because I personally had some very serious run-ins with him and was very vocal in my concerns directly to Dempsey and also very clear in my concerns to Randy Bola. So, you know, this happened 7 months ago, six, 7 months ago. All the concerns that I had, I talked directly to Dempsey, and not one of them was addressed appropriately, not one. Not a one, I can tell you. You know, if I was to ask him, please remove the splinter from my finger, I guarantee you my finger would be festering right now. So that is how responsive that fellow was. And so it wasn't just me. There were several other complaints and several other concerns. And the curious thing is that the complaints and the concerns were voiced primarily by people of color, the African-American caucus, the Asian-American caucus, the Hispanic caucus. You know, it makes you wonder, right? It makes you think. And district chairs as well, and many of the district chairs being people of color as well. So there was that concern, okay? So we were very there were the complaints that were made. So anyway, bottom line is, Dempsey was let go. That is well within Randy Bowler's purview, his purview. Now let me ask you one other thing. Do you think anyone who would just simply fire someone without the advice of counsel would have to be plumb stupid? S-T-O-O-P-I-D. Okay?
Right.
Would
absolutely
be plumb stupid. Randy Bowler ain't stupid. Okay, he may be a doofus sometimes. I'm a doofus sometimes. You're a doofus sometimes. Okay, but that's part of human nature.
Going to my wife.
But stupid, really, right? But stupid, you're not.
No.
Stupid, you're not. And so you can ask Randy this, but the best of my understanding, when I discussed this, Randy did seek legal opinion, and the legal opinion came down that he had every right, because, again, the ED served within, at the pleasure of the chair. Okay, so that's done. Then Randy, having met Dr. Chavis and then finding out that Dr. Chavis had wanted to come back and was coming back to North Carolina to help, because he was inspired by the Moral Mondays and inspired the Elizabeth City, right, Montravious.
Right.
So he was inspired by all that was going on. So Dr. King wanted to come back to North Carolina to help us win elections. At which point in time, the thought was, you know, hey, and remember, Dr. Cave has never submitted an application to be the executive director. Never. Not for a second.
Right.
Not for a second. Mm-hmm. The thought was, okay, let's use Dr. Chambers to the best of his ability and maybe bring in the people who are currently not registered to vote. So now let me throw some figures at you, which were brought to my attention. There are 9.7 million voters
in Iran, so you know that.
All right. So the percentage of African-Americans in North Carolina, 22%, which comes to about 1,600,000, something like that. However, the number of registered blacks, there's a huge disparity. Mm-hmm. It's over 150,000 that are not registered to vote. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you take into account, you know, that maybe 23%.
And I think that's a small number. I think that's a small number. Too.
It is a small number, but I'm erring on the side of caution. Okay,
right.
I'm just erring on the side of caution, being very conservative and these are the 2012 census numbers. It's a 2012 census number. So you're right, it is a smaller number because 2013 the numbers are bigger. But I don't have, and the numbers that were presented to me did not factor in, I didn't have all of the 2013 numbers, so only had 2012 numbers. So I kind of looked at that, and with the help of some of my other nerdy friends, we managed to figure out that there's a disparity of about 150,000 to 175,000 people, blacks, who are living in North Carolina that are not registered to vote. The majority of this is the slightly over 18, the young crowd, the hip-hop crowd, if you will, the small crowd,
right.
Okay,
right.
The young crowd. Now, if you factor in also the Asian Americans and the Hispanic Americans that live in North Carolina could very well vote, but are not registered to vote, you're talking about over 300,000 people. That's equivalent to 400,000 people, okay? And if you factor in 2013 and you do the math, it might be even 500,000 people. This is go small now. That is 300,000 people, 300,000 to 500,000 people who ordinarily are inclined to vote Democratic, okay, who are not registered to vote that Dr. Chavis could have and would have brought in, and I hope he still will consider it, reached out to them with, you know, because he knows how to do this, to reach out to them, to bring them, engage them, bring them in to become registered to vote, and then vote Democratic. So what do we do? Instead of looking at, oh, wow, this is one talented fella and we should utilize, what do we do? We then have someone who decides they're going to do oppositional research, which is okay. You can do oppositional research. But instead of bringing it to the council and instead of bringing it to the chair, decides, no, I think I'll just go to the press with this.
Mm.
And not only go to the press, then send out the one-sided information, okay, that Dr. Chavis is guilty of sexual harassment, you know, 20 years ago. Two sexual harassment cases. Well, you know what? I went down the back door of that, okay? They weren't sexual harassment cases. It was sexual discrimination, not harassment. Discrimination, which means, oh, you gave the job to a guy and you didn't give it to me. I'm just as qualified. I'm a woman. So here's the story. If you don't settle with me and you don't give me the money that I want, I'm going to embarrass the NAACP. And if you remember, 20 years ago, the NAACP was on its last leg. It really was. Had any negative publicity come out about it, it'd be dead. We wouldn't have it today. So, you know, say what you will. Dr. Chavis settled with them, you know, quietly. Maybe he made a mistake. Okay, let's just say he made a mistake. All right, so he made a mistake. Not once, but twice, because both of them were sexual discrimination cases. The second sexual discrimination case basically was, oh, look, the first person with all this money, I want some too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what it was. That is essentially what it was. I want some too. So let's say that Dr. Chavis did make two errors. Let's also, who has not made a mistake in their life?
Absolutely.
Anybody? Anybody? Anybody?
That's right.
I don't know.
Yep.
Okay, so let's just say he did make that mistake. Now let me ask you this. From 1994 to now, 2014, what has Dr. Chavis done? What has has he done with his life?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, does nobody look at that? Does not nobody look at how he has been, how he has pulled, literally dragged the NAACP into being an inclusive organization to include, hello, include not just blacks, but other people of color? Because what does NAACP stand for? Association of Colored People? Okay? I mean,
yes.
Duh. So Dr. Chavis has done that. Well, yes, okay, so he did, he converted to converted to Islam, but he unconverted. That's okay, too. You know how many, I was a Catholic, born a Catholic. Well, you know what? I dropped my Catholicism because I got mad at the Catholic Church. But I'm back now in the Catholic Church. So what do you want to do? You want to say that, you want to hold that against me, that I dropped the Catholic Church? Fine, go ahead.
Pope Francis doesn't say that.
Thank
well,
you.
I think you're absolutely right. And right now we have joining us chairman of the Democratic Party in North Carolina, our Randy Bowler. Mr. Chairman?
Well, nice to be here, Michael. I had so many things going on today. I'm sorry to be a little late, but it's better late than never.
Always better. You know, and sometimes when you make a grand entrance to the party, people look at you more.
Well, I guess we've proven one thing in my tenure as chairman, which was the same thing that happened in my 8 years as mayor. We've proven that we're relevant. You know, when I got to the job, they said, no one cares about the Democratic Party. It's not relevant.
Right.
I said, well, look at the headlines we demonstrated. I think we're relevant because somehow
you
guys
were
interested. Oh, yeah. You know, they claimed we weren't relevant. Apparently, we're very relevant.
Well, we have our chair of the 8th Congressional District was just giving us a major peek inside some of the commotion that's going on with the Democratic Party. But it's not as much as what's going on with Art Pope and the Republican Party in this state when the federal subpoenas start coming out.
Yes, you know, we've got a press release coming out talking about Governor McCrory's love affair with Duke. Happy Valentine's Day. We have this horrific spill that no one wants to talk about. They'd rather talk about foolishness instead of the destruction of the environment and the degradation of our drinking water and a failure not only of reasonable environmental regulations, but new ways of thinking to deal with energy and our waste.
Well, I said at the beginning of the show, I was going to keep repeating this for the whole show. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. And that's just what these people, these progressive mongrels, are doing to this country. They don't want, you know, and these are the people who want to hunt. These are the people who want guns so they can hunt and shoot fish even. Well, now they're going to shoot deer that are drinking out of the coal-ash sludge in the river, and they're going to kill themselves and fish out of the ponds with the coal-ash sludge in the water. So now what do they do now? Can they blame that on Obamacare? Can they blame it on the ACA? Or just blame Obama? Who's to blame for this?
Well, one thing I want to point out before we get into the entire details of it again, I do think it's a very telling moment that while we have, I think, an endless litany of real-time crimes and attempts at repression and law changes and everything else that are flying out of this Republican Party that we are suffering under right now in North Carolina, while that is real time. I mean, they're covering up coal ash spills. They're trying to, you know, pass laws preventing nipples. I mean, everything possible that they can think of in the weirdness of their small minds, and yet the controversy that they have to stir up over here on our side is maybe 20 years ago he didn't hire enough women, or maybe 20 years ago he thought about religion. You know, that's pretty telling. That is pretty extraordinary. that's the choice of, you know, well, we may be dumping 87,000, you know, gallons into a river, or, hey, how about that guy? I bet in 1960 he did something. Maybe he jaywalked.
Well, they already started bringing up Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. I mean, they've already
because that's what they have to go on.
Because they have nothing
else. That's all they have to go on. Yes.
Mr. Chair, tell us, how are you going to go about getting these our chairman of the 8th District so graciously talked about over 100,000 African Americans to vote this year?
We're not going to stop the concept of democracy revival. That was something I sat down. I'm an entrepreneur and an artist, and you know, I mean, I'm a musician, and I, you know, thought that reviving democracy, and I speak about it around the state, is the way to go. And Ben and I met for coffee about it when he was down at an engagement in Durham months and months and months ago. And so we really need to bring in all these disparate groups. We're not going to stop doing that, regardless of some people and their inability to see kind of the long-term vision and letting themselves be gripped by fear. So in Charlotte, when you have the CIAA coming down there in a couple weeks, I've already got a venue. We're working on that. We've got five acts coming there, and we're going to keep going, and we're going to start it right there in your home city.
Well, hey,
is it a rock the vote event?
What's that?
Is it a rock the vote event?
We're going to call it probably Democracy Rocks. So it's something
completely
branded and new with me, with Ben and others. I mean, that will include all of you be included. I mean, Gracie, everybody. You know, Robbie, Adhiri, all of them. We're all invited to come in. But it's the concept I've been working through, and I just said, you know, instead of arguing with people, instead of letting folks sit there with pettiness and debate on the line, let's do what we always should do. Let our actions show. So, I mean, I've been on news media where they interview me and they want to know, are you conservative? Are you liberal? Are you socialist? Are you a GOP plant that they claim? I said, you know what? All you have to do is judge someone by their actions when they're in office, their votes, and what they do. And we'll just show you. We're going to show you with our actions.
Absolutely. Well, there was how many people do you know, or do you figure, or have you guesstimated that should have voted that did not turn out? That didn't turn out.
I mean, in the last election, the numbers were astronomical.
And I'm talking 2010. 2010.
I mean, they were astronomical. Is kind of a very hyperbolic adjective, but
yes.
there was a huge number of non-turnout, and I think you were down in the 40s percent in terms of turnout. The Republicans were energized and maximized their yields, and the Democrats were not, and there were a lot of reasons for that.
Yep.
But one of the things that I have a problem with when folks come to you with fear and they say, you know, let's just say, you know, it's Michael Lawson. You can't have Michael Lawson out there running. Oh, we're not going to be able to get these people, or we won't be able to do that. I said, you know what? You're misreading these unaffiliates. And I have elected officials, statewide elected officials, trying to give me their opinions on this as if they can peer into the hearts of men and women. And I said, look, from all of my experience traveling around the state and the country, people that are unaffiliated, because I was one for 18 years, it's because they don't think the parties stand for anything, but they have a general sense of values. And their values, you can see exemplified by HK on J or Moral Mondays. People come out on the basis of the values they believe in. It's not that all these unaffiliates are more conservative than Democrats. That's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
They're just interested in issues, and they decided that the parties don't address the issues, but they want to caucus with you. And if you show them that you actually stand up, they're with you, and they'll give money to you, and they'll go out and help you.
True.
I think that the Democratic Party has to show that, or else it won't be able to mobilize the people we need to win this fall, and we won't be able to take the anger of HK on J and Moral Mondays and translate it specifically into action. You know, if Gracie's still on the line, I got a report from the pollster from the DNC, who Dr. Chavis met with in D.C. last week, Ron Lester. Your district, the 8th Congressional District, is now over 40% African-American, the newest demographics they have. Mm-hmm. The district really should be won by a progressive-minded Democrat, or, you know, or a Democrat that's, whose values are going to basically espouse, you know, community investment, building our places. Mayor Antonio Blue would make a good candidate. There's no reason why we should be running somebody center-right. We should be running someone who wants to build for the people. No
reason at all.
And by the way, Mayor Antonio Blue did file.
Excellent.
That's very good. Excellent.
All right.
Okay.
I bet you Mayor Antonio Blue won't be mad if a civil rights leader comes and tries to help him, because apparently when Dr. Chavis made 50,000 phone calls around the state, including for Patrick Cannon, that certainly didn't seem to hurt the election.
I don't think so.
Nobody seems to want to talk about that.
We have someone else who's joining the conversation. Hello, who's this? Hello? Anybody there? Nope? Okay. I thought somebody was. But anyway, the thing is that we have to wrap this up, the chairman and chairwoman. Very sure, because we have some other people coming on. But I want a number from you, Grace. How, if people want to come and help the campaign, how can they help you in the 8th District?
Okay, they can call me. Here's my cell phone number. It's 980-322-5447. That is my cell phone number. Now, if you call and I don't answer because I don't recognize your number, tell me who you are. I'll call you back.
And, Mr. Chairman, how can I help the Democratic Party? Oh, who is the interim ED in North Carolina now for the party?
The interim ED is Casey Mann. She is she helped in the elections last fall in Mecklenburg. She's been an activist, a grassroots worker, worked in Democratic politics for the last 10 years, well-regarded with her trainings and work on organizing. And you know, Dr. Chavis likes her a lot. He knows her. So we have a good, strong woman in here, and we're up and running, and I've been up here all 3 days during the snowstorm. Unlike our governor, as I told you, Michael, I actually knew it was going to have a three-day storm, so I packed appropriately and stayed at the hotel. Apparently, I can look at the weather projections and prepare.
Oh, wow.
That's because you're using science.
Oh,
well,
please,
you know what?
Doctor,
exactly. Don't confuse the issue with facts, please.
That's right. Let me ask you a question, Mr. Chair. Is there going to be a notice that there's going to be a filing for the position, or how does this work? The interim position.
Right now, we're in the 30 days, and we're going to discuss what's going to happen, and we'll have, there are various people that have expressed interest, including Dr. Chavis, and we'll play this by ear. But right now we have a good, strong acting executive director, and I think it's positive to have a woman who's essentially come up through the ranks, who almost died in an automobile accident, who worked herself through college and paid for herself. I mean, she exemplifies what the Democrats stand for, hard work.
I would definitely love if you could convey my my sentiments to her and have her come on the show possibly next week.
I will. I'm excited about, really, you know, sometimes when you have a catharsis, it's actually positive. I had one of our editors and publishers for one of our black newspapers called me up today, and he said, "Randy, I just want you to know, you just exposed that the emperor has no clothes." You can read into what he meant.
It's better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. We got to remember that. That's what these people are out for. So I want to thank the chairman of the North Carolina Democratic Party and the chairperson of the North Carolina 8th Congressional District for being on the show today.
I'll let Casey know about coming on the show. Thanks
a lot,
Michael.
Know about coming on the show. No problem. And I will say, I will see you shortly, Madam Chair.
Indeed. Indeed.
I will
absolutely.
See you shortly. I hope we can get together very soon.
I
Thank
think
you.
We should. Thank you, Michael.
Bye-bye.
As usual,
Bye-bye.
It's a great pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye. Mr. Thomas.
Yes, sir.
That was our doctor in the house leaving. We have a call in here because we have another guest waiting. Let me see who this guest is here. Hello, who's this?
It's Matt Newton.
Matt, how are you?
Yes, sir. Michael, wonderful, wonderful. Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you very much. And my wife had a walk. She said, well, you didn't shovel the sidewalk. I said, shovel the sidewalk? You got to have a shovel to shovel the sidewalk. Anyway, the thing is, she walked out up the block to meet her coworker who took her to work because her car is snowed in. We have how long can you hold on, Matt?
As long as you need me.
Okay, I want you to hold on because I have another guest. I got two more, and I want to get to my important guest in just a minute. So just hold on, Matt. Yes, who's this? Hello? Okay, we're not there. So, but right now we are going to go to a gentleman who I met who is unbelievable, the thing that he has put together. His name is William Michael Cunningham. And because his name is Michael, he's got to be one genius of a guy. He is an economist, an investment advisor, a researcher, a social investing policy analyst. He evaluates, he develops, and he creates specific social responsible investments. He also produces statistical models he created using his fully adjusted return methodology, signaled the possibility of system-wide economic market failure. Now, I got all that out. How about that? But he has he has also been involved with a major, program analysis that he has that he is doing. And this thing that he wants to talk about is something called crowdfunding. Michael Cunningham,
yes,
tell us about yourself.
Well, thank you for having me on. I hope you can hear me okay.
I can hear you fine.
Okay. So, you know, I'm an economist trained at University of Chicago, and I've been using that training to get capital and investments and money and skills to underserved communities, you know, low to moderate income, minority, women, businesses, that sort of thing. And back in 2002, you know, I was concerned about the lack of funding in some of these same communities, you know, and came up with something called the Microcredit Stock Exchange, which was basically a little neighborhood stock exchange, small scale. You know, you could have a stock exchange in the corner deli if you wanted to have one there, you know. So, and it could provide
some
equity.
Of
you know,
go ahead.
Get your pastrami on rye and share of stock in the dry cleaners,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
So now that has developed into something called crowdfunding, which is as it sounds. It's when a crowd of people decide to put money into a venture, a nonprofit, a social venture, or a for-profit company, a dry cleaners, or a watch company, or a restaurant, or something like that. And you can do this online now through something called the Jobs Act. The Jobs Act was a law that was passed in April of 2012 that mandated that the Securities and Exchange Commission look for ways to or allow the little tiny companies out there to raise money, equity capital, raise money online for their businesses. And it's a game changer, I tell you, because it means that, you know, small businesses that have been shut out of these equity markets forever now have a way, possibly, that they can go out and raise money for their company, for what they're doing. And we've seen it work. It's worked very well. About $2.1 billion in funding was arranged through crowdfunding in 2012. 2013, we expect, when the numbers finally come in, we expect that number to be about $6 billion in total. So it's really a growing, and we have been very active. I wrote a book on the Jobs Act and on crowdfunding, published by A-Press, which is a computer book publishing company up in New York, titled The Jobs Act, Crowdfunding for Startups and Small Businesses, that basically goes through the details of this. So, you know, I'm on the show today to talk about that and make sure that people are aware that there is this new way in which they can raise equity capital, raise capital for their small businesses or for their idea, for their startup, you know, anything that they want to do. Now, of course, there are some restrictions. There are some parameters, guidelines that you have to go through in order to do this, and that's all to the good. Because what we're seeing is a huge increase in creativity, innovation, small companies that not only were locked out of the credit markets, but we're also maybe being held down by some of the big guys. So this is a way that those companies can now access enough money to be able to get off the ground.
Well, you know, I don't want to interrupt you, but I think we were talking, you had mentioned this is a little bit the same, on the same line that the President Obama, now President Obama, got some of his funding going.
It's exactly the same thing. It's what he used in 2007 and 2008. It's the same idea. Little donations, $10, $20. You know, those little donations add up if you've got a good idea and if you've got a good movement going, then you can really raise some significant capital. And now what the law allows you to do, see, for the Obama campaign, of course, those were all donations. People were just donating $10, $20. Well, now, if you're a company, if you have a little, like I say, that deli on the street corner, and you want to raise $100,000 to, I don't know, buy a new cutting machine or something, you know, it's a very expensive cutting machine, but let's say you want to do that. Well, you can sell stakes, ownership stakes in that deli to people on the street, to your customers, to other people online in your business.
Now, what you're saying is that, let's take what you just said, ownership stakes. What does that mean? You're selling a piece of that, you're selling the 1% of your business, so any property you give, they get 1%?
That's exactly right. Some percentage. Okay. Let's say you're selling 60% of the of the company. So that's right. Mm-hmm. Your new partners, your new equity owners, would be entitled to 60%,
right,
if that's the amount that you're selling, of the profits that come into that company. That's right. In addition to having, you know, the ownership stake. Now, it gets a little technical. I don't want to get into all of the technicalities. You know, you could structure it so that instead of getting 60%, people could get 80% or 40%. But let's ignore all of that. The bottom line is exactly as you said. The what you get in exchange for that equity stake in that company is an ownership stake. And as an owner, you get part of the income, if there is any.
If there is any. Now, what if you're a non-for-profit?
Then if you're a 501c3. Yep, what most people, what we've seen, and there are a lot of good websites that focus on non-for-profit groups, then you're really talking about donations for not-for-profit. So you're not expecting an ownership stake in the not-for-profit because it's a non-profit. But you're donating or you're participating because you like what the non-profit is doing.
Well, that's the same thing then. When people invested in Obama running for senator or president, same thing.
That's exactly right.
There was
exactly
nothing
right
that they got back. I mean, you know, it's not like Duke Power investing in McCrory for 28 years. Now he's governor and he's killing all regulation. I mean, it's not the same thing.
That's right.
Investment is investment, Mike.
I mean, so, the idea, though, is that this is going to generate people at the grassroots level who are aware of what's going on. Let's go back to that Delhi example. So let's say you've lived in that community for 20 years, and there have been no stores around, you know, there's nothing around, but it's a great spot. Let's say there's a bus stop in front of the deli that where 15 buses, you know, all converge, you know, at lunchtime. Well, if you're in that neighborhood, you know that's a great spot. And you know that if there's a deli that's put on that corner, it's going to do well. I mean, they have to be really not business savvy in order not to do well. So let's say you decide you want to raise $100,000 to open a deli on that corner and sell shares to people in the neighborhood, you know. That's what this is designed to do.
Well, I want to thank you, Wayne, for coming on and giving us
fantastic.
A little insight. And I'd like to have you come back next week and give us a little more insight of what's going on and how this works.
Absolutely. Now, our crowdfunding platform is called blackcrowdfunding.net, blackcrowdfunding.net. Some of the other ones are Kickstarter, Indiegogo, GoFundMe. There are a bunch that are out there. It's a huge movement now, and we're seeing some really interesting, really innovative products and projects, and, you know, it's really an exciting time.
I really appreciate you calling in, and hope to hear from you next week.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
I thank you. That was William Michael Cunningham, who has a fabulous idea, and it's called Black Crowdfunding. It's a way to get your business off the table and working. Thank you, Michael. And William, I'm going to call you Michael, not William, because that's my name. I like that.
Because everybody should be named Michael, right?
That's right. Everybody should be named Michael. Now, we have other people holding here. David, I'll be right with you. Matt,
hey,
I'm with you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Thomas.
I just want to say one thing real quick about the Jobs Act. One thing that's interesting about it, and just to relate it to North Carolina, since we're sitting here in North Carolina, it was a growth out of a series of bills. But the main one was the Entrepreneur Access to Capital Act that Patrick McHenry of North Carolina originally introduced. And one of the interesting features of it was that it was a whole series of bills that Republicans and Democrats jointly worked on and reformed and molded together to create this Crowdfunding and Jobs Act, as it became later.
Right.
But I think it's very interesting. It came out of a North Carolinian, and then it was a bipartisan act, if you will. So I just thought that was just to point it out.
Isn't that something? Isn't that something? Okay. Matthew, we have about three minutes. What can you tell me? You are running for what seat in North Carolina?
State Senate District 40.
State District. Senate District 4, that's the seat for Malcolm Graham used to hold.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We are on the eastern side of Charlotte from Johnson C. Smith up to the university, circling around to encompass Harrisburg all the way back down to where Independence and Matthews meet.
And what is the reason why you want this seat?
I feel like we need, as a district, and let's face it, as a state, strong leaders who will not be sitting in office for the title, but who will be proactive members of the legislature, who will propose, draft, and sponsor, and aggressively do so, legislation that benefits the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many... I guess, when's your first fundraiser?
We're hoping to organize a fundraiser here in the next 3 weeks, and you guys will be the first to know, Michael and Thomas. I want to point out a couple of things. Of course, I will be advocating for a stronger public education system, affordable and accountable health care, jobs for our district, and laws that are more employee-friendly, laws that will allow folks within our state to not be the subject of discrimination in the workplace and also allow them to earn a living wage. But also, and I think a hallmark of my track record and what I hope to bring to the position is a focus on social justice issues. As you know, over the past year, I worked with over 10 community organizations to reform our Citizens Review Board. We currently, I've been speaking with state legislators about proposing a new bill that would allow municipalities across the entire state to implement their own citizens review boards, strengthen them by giving them subpoena power, as well as strengthen our judicial system to ensure that we have equal justice under the law. So expanding expungement laws so we can cut back on recidivism, as well as give people an opportunity to move on with their lives after making a mistake, strengthen domestic violence laws, and for maybe once in a long history, fully fund indigent defense services throughout the state.
Well, you know, you're speaking about something that, and you're speaking from a lawyer position because you are a fabulous lawyer. I just need to ask you one question. What amendment is it in the Constitution states that's all it's put in? It's about habeas corpus. How can someone be locked up for a year in jail without being charged with a crime?
Yeah, I think what we're talking about is due process of law. That would be the 14th Amendment. And it is a travesty without being tried. And we have an imperfect system. There's no doubt about that. That is something, and I've heard about what's been happening in Franklin County, and that is something that our legislature can take a more stringent look at because it is an issue that has filtered through the state court system, and it's something that is governed. Granted, there are parameters within the 14th Amendment for the sake of appropriate and proper due process, but something that is nevertheless governed by state statute. And there can be accommodations made for special circumstances in our state statutes, and it's something that can be reviewed. And I believe it would be, and not to get all nerdy on you, Michael, but it would be Section 15 and 15A of our general statutes.
Well, the thing is that it's one thing being held in jail if you're in Guantanamo. But I didn't think they could allow to have Guantanamo on U.S. soil. Because if you're held without, well, you are charged and then charges are dropped, so now you're being held against your will. And nobody does anything about it. I mean, this is like, you know, this is something out of a movie in a small southern town somewhere, thing that you heard about in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. How can this go on in the 21st century?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it raises the specter of 287G as well, ICE holds and the deportation process. I think that what we have here is we have an unfair discretion placed upon the localities where, you know, where incidents occur, and the district court judges, right? We as an electorate need to make sure that we're electing the right judges who will be making decisions of whether or not to place holds on bonds or outrageous bonds in the first place. And then again, too, I think you touched on this a second ago. State statute can really tie the hands of any judge who is engaged in activism and in potential borderline profiling. So there are ways, but for the time being, it is a process where our voices are going to be the rallying call for change. And I believe, and I don't know all the facts about what's mm-hmm. happened in Franklin County. So I don't feel fully educated from a general law standpoint.
I mean, when would it be that the Attorney General comes in, or a federal agency? What would tip it to push it in that direction?
Technically, it's upon the request of the district attorney, or in the alternative, now SBI can be called in too by the local chief of police. I think that
that ain't gonna happen.
I think a concerted effort could be made by the community to require or mandate that the district attorney ask for independent oversight and investigation by the Attorney General's office, and certainly someone who sits in the seat of senator, House representative, so general assemblyman, and no doubt about it. And once again, we're talking about the realm of possibility, right? Not necessarily reality, but the governor's office. If the governor wanted to take a stand, then there would be no doubt about it that the attorney general, that a local district attorney and the attorney general local district attorney would make that call to the attorney general. For the time being, we can certainly review Chapter 15A of our general statutes and in place limitations, right? I think what would be appropriate is a time limitation for the disclosure of information that could pertain to the seriousness of any particular offense, and whether or not the bond that's been placed or a hold on that bond is appropriate. A judge, what they do, and it's within their discretion, a district court judge district court judges, because they also place bonds in the case of a felony, so superior court cases. What a district court judge does is they consider whether or not the individual who's being held in custody is a flight risk, or alternatively, or both, a danger to himself or others. And sometimes the seriousness of the alleged offense places that judge in the position to impose an extremely strict bond. And in the case of murder, that isn't unusual. However, there needs to be accommodation for the fact that not everybody who has been charged with an offense automatically guilty. And you have placed that burden upon them by holding them for an indefinite period of time. And then further, I think the real tragedy here in cases where folks are the victims the innocent victims of alleged crimes or being accused of involvement in a crime, is the fact that they're you can't get that time back. Those folks who have been placed in jail in this particular instance for 1 year period, the young man or whomever else can't go back, and make up for missed schooling. If anything, it can be that much more difficult for the individual to re-enroll. Can't go back and make up for losing a home or an apartment. You name it, right? Can't go back and spend time with their children. Right. And that's the delicate counterplay here and the balance that has to be reached within state law and within the judiciary.
Well, what I'd like to ask is if our Attorney General Roy Cooper runs for governor, would you consider running for Attorney General for North Carolina?
It depends on what the people want, Michael. I will leave that up to everyone else, and definitely leave my options open. But for the time being, I think I would be an effective representative in the state senate. So I would ask everyone to please consider voting for me on May 6th.
Okay, and what's the number they can get a hold of you?
I'll give you my office number, and I also have a website that will be up here in the next couple of days.
The office number is area code 704-280-8493. And the website is votemattnewton.com.
Very good. I want to thank you. That's right.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Thomas.
I want to thank you.
Yes, sir.
Very, very good. And vote for Matt Newton, District 40 candidate, State Senate. Thank you.
Thank you.
And, hey, Matt.
Yes, he's gone.
One last thing.
I got right. Yeah. Go ahead.
Let's update everything and fix all your various websites, because I browse around on Facebook and other things. So let's get all that presence back present.
Absolutely. Right now, we have a gentleman who's been on top of the story of Shannon Namadi. Well, he's got to correctly pronounce it for me, because I don't have my glasses, so I can't even read it. But anyway, his name is David Adams. David.
How are you, Mike? Always a pleasure, my friend. And, yes, I will correct you. The young man's name is Shannon Zachariah Namodi.
Namodi. Okay, Shannon Zachariah Namodi. Very good. I was trying to solicit some advice from Matt Newton, who is a fabulous lawyer here in Charlotte. He got the Civilian Review Board to change how they to make them more involved in cases, especially with shootings in the department. They now will get a hold of the original write-up by the policeman. So he changed all that, and he is somebody great. And I was just wondering what you thought of some of the things that he said about the case before I asked you about the case.
Yeah, I listened to what Mr. Newton was saying, and, you know, the North Carolina General Statute 15A, that he was talking about, I don't think it necessarily applies to this particular case. One of the problems with this particular case in general is the fact that the state of North Carolina does not have what's called a speedy trial statute, which you will see in most cases, where they require that you have a defendant. It was repealed back in 1989, actually. They require those kinds of statutes typically require that the state have a trial, have a defendant before the courts between 90 and 180 days. Okay, and I know my home state, which is Maryland, they have what is called the Hicks Law. They have to have you in trial within 180 days. That's the biggest problem. So I don't think North Carolina General Statute 15A necessarily applies. I think it's the fact that you guys don't have a speedy trial statute, and you really couldn't do anything about it till after a year, when, as he stated, the 14th and the Sixth Amendment rights have become infringed upon.
Well, yeah, but you tell me that a year is okay? It could be 5 years.
Well, for some unknown reason, you guys repealed your speedy trial right, your speedy trial statute in 1989. I don't know why that was done, but it was repealed. So, unfortunately, that's the reality.
Find out about that. But in reality, does that mean he could be held like the people in Guantanamo?
Well, no, because typically most jurisdictions, the judges are aware that the guy's going to have these constitutional rights looming, and that statute requires, the standard is 70 days. So even though you don't have that speedy trial statute, it's a situation where the court should be mindful that we got to get this guy, we still have to treat this as a speedy trial situation.
Well, but isn't it a violation of habeas corpus?
Well, you can always present in habeas corpus at any time, but in this particular case, it's been rejected twice by two separate Superior Court judges.
And what are their names?
Judge Hobgood, who's the resident senior judge for Franklin County, and then there
What's
was also
name?
Judge Johnson, who
How
refused to even look at the read the document.
How do you spell Hobgood?
Hobgood is H-O-B G-O-O-D.
Okay, and what's the other one's name?
Johnson. I don't know his first name.
Now, here's something, Mike, not to defend what they're saying, but to back what he just said up. I was flipping around online and on the North Carolina criminal law blog that they run out of UNC. They say that because we don't have a speedy trial, the average time in North Carolina for dispositions is 528 days.
Holy cow!
That's average. I mean, you're talking about...
Don't even have, some of the prisoners in Guantanamo were released sooner.
Well, there you go. So that kind of sheds light on this to say how they're defending it, that they're not doing anything, quote-unquote, wrong. They're just slowly plodding along like they always do.
Okay, but, you know, all right, fine.
Which is no defense for this poor boy that's sitting in jail. But
all right, okay, then David, tell me, before I ask you to explain to the audience the significance and how this young man got in this situation, how do they keep someone in court, or, I mean, in jail, when they have no evidence?
Well, see, that's the whole problem. That's the whole problem, you know, and my last commentary on my blog, I really spoke on this, you know, things were done wrong. There's a lot of funny paperwork pertaining to this case. And, you know, you can say that you got this evidence and that evidence all day long, but until you present that evidence, you don't have a case. And what we have here, we have a police affidavit that was generated through the Franklin County Sheriff's Department, which has a handwritten addendum on there indicating that this particular young man had actually, in fact, confessed to the crime. Now, you say a year, but we're actually over 16 months, going on 17 months now into this case, and they have yet to produce any forensic evidence, you know, or any police reports to indicate what their investigative findings were to justify even charging this young man, okay? If you go to the Franklin County Courthouse for yourself and check the file, the statement of charges, which the arresting officer, which would have been Franklin County Deputy Ralph Omquist, when he took the kid into custody or when he swore out for the warrant, the statement of charges, which normally accompanies, you know, application for an arrest warrant, isn't even present in the file. You know,
well,
so there's something else going on here.
Well, yeah, that very true. But listen, I mean, everybody's watched detective shows. Everybody's watched cop shows. You know, UK LA law they have. I mean, UK law they have. But how long can a police department hold you without charging you? I mean, I thought it was 48 hours, 72 hours.
Well, each jurisdiction in various states have their own statute. Some is 24, some is 48, some is up to 72 hours, okay?
Okay,
but
so what's the
interesting part about this case is that he's not being held as a person, you know, a person of interest. He's actually being detained in jail, and there's no pending charges in the court management system docket whatsoever, okay? It's like they took the case off for the docket. And when you do that, you typically mean saying that you're dropping the charges, but the kid's still in custody. That's essentially unheard of on this planet.
You know,
this is what you were talking about earlier. This is why they make movies about the South, because this crap only happens down here. I mean, it's from Mars. It's unbelievable, but it happened, like you said, in the 30s, in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, and it's still happening now.
This is the 21st century. And
it's unbelievable.
That means if I'm driving down the street in Franklin County and I run a red light and I don't have my driver's license or insurance card with me, he'll take me into custody and hold me for 525 days?
Hmm.
Are you kidding me? David?
Huh. Hey, you know, I don't know. That, you know, from this case, Mike, it appears to be that's definitely a possibility, you know. But, you know, that from the onset, there were problems. This case was problematic, okay?
Tell us,
because
tell us a little bit about the story, because there's some people who I'm sure haven't heard it. Tell us the story.
Well, the case, back on August 16th of 2012, young Shannon Namodi was outside of his friend's home. Apparently they had came from a music gig. He fell asleep inside the car and was awakened by gunshots or someone screaming in distress. When he looks up, he sees a white woman running towards the house where he's at. And she tells him that someone shot her and her daughter was involved. You know, the young man and the house where he was at, that family came out. They aided the woman until the cops got there. Okay, the woman told the cops from two different police agencies, the Franklin County Sheriff's Department, as well as the Youngsville Police, that Shannon, their reports I'm hearing that she said that Shannon didn't do it. But what I can, testify to as a fact, that police reports exist, you know, where they stated that the woman said that someone struck her with a pole, okay, indicating if you say someone, then that means that you don't know who the assailant was. That's what the primary officers on the scene's reports reflect, okay? Somehow, this young man, Shannon Amodi, was charged with the crime, okay, despite these earlier reports. And I even interviewed the witness. Now she's saying that the kid shot her, okay? And I questioned her on, the statements that she gave the cops. You know, she gave me a complete different version what she told the police. And if you look at those two police reports that are on file, those are two different versions within itself. So the story really, really stinks. And then the kicker is that some of the witnesses that were there told the cops that they seen a white male running from the scene that night. One person's, his account was so detailed that he even showed the cops the path and the direction that the guy ran. Okay, but none of these reports are present in the file. Okay, that's suppression of evidence. Okay, I say this case has some problems from the onset.
Right.
Well, that's the part that bothers me the most. Hey, Mike, just to point out what he just said, it isn't only that all the witnesses have different things and that different things have been reported. That's one thing. The part that bothers me and shows instantaneously that there is an institutional corruption or conspiracy ongoing is the fact that, as what I've read in his blog and other places, there are files now missing from the courthouse and missing from the police reports that were there before. That's completely different and a criminal act in a whole different way.
Right now, we have on the phone with us the mother of Shannon, Elizabeth Crudup. Is that how you spell your name? Say your name? Elizabeth? Elizabeth, are you? Oh, wait a minute. I didn't put her in. Let me get her in here. I'm sorry, Elizabeth. Are you there now?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine.
Okay.
Elizabeth, tell us... Tell us what you know. You are the mother of Shannon. Have you been able to see him?
I have not been able to see him recently. The last day I saw him was in January, was the 16th, well, not the 16th, after the 16th of January, I think it was the 20th, the day that the second habeas was filed. By special arrangement, I was able to see him. On that day, and when I say see him, I mean when I got in there to see him, he's surrounded by all the superior jail wardens, all the lieutenants and the captain and everyone else. But, I did get to lay eyes on him then, and he's not, his spirit, his body is there, but they're really, really putting the screws to this young man. I'm very proud of his resilience. He has always maintained his innocence. In fact, I knew more about this crime than he did, because all he knew is that a woman came bleeding from the head. He didn't know anything about daughter and all these plots and plans. He knew nothing. And he was being charged essentially for being black. Needless to say, the victim was a white woman, and my son was the only black person in the cul-de-sac that evening. And he had no choice in whether he came out black or white. That was up to his parents. And he's a black man of character. He is a good person. He was actually headed to the Marines. He had graduated high school. He was just a young person being young with his friends. He had started a part-time job as an electrician's assistant. So this was not someone who was wasting away. He had plans for his life. And it has all been curtailed and stopped by the Franklin County Sheriff's Department and the prosecution in this case. And it's a crying shame. It's a crying shame that they've allowed it to go on for so long, knowing full well he had nothing to do with it.
Why was he surrounded?
Is this terrorist? Why was he surrounded?
I don't understand. What is the threat?
He's in jail.
They are intimidating this boy. They are treating him. The last time I saw treatment like this was in apartheid South Africa. What they used to do to Winnie Mandela and other members of the ANC to get them to break. You know, this is the last time I saw this kind of treatment. This is what they do to people who want to break their spirits. They cannot. I do not know if they've harmed him physically. He's not been able to talk to me, but every time he mentions the prosecution, or this is what he calls them, he mentions the criminal guys. He said, Mama, the criminal guys, and he holds the sides of his chair and his eyes roll to the back of his head, you know, and not in a good way, in a very terrifying way. I am concerned about my child. He needs to come out of there. I don't know what they may do to him, but we know that they are in the wrong. I sent a letter to my child informing him of the same. I said, it doesn't matter what someone brings to your face. You know, they cannot do anything to you because it's them in the wrong. They cannot try you. They cannot threaten you with 30 years in jail as they have over and over again. They have tried to excommunicate him from his family. Just literally hold him cuddle like an enemy combatant. This is just now he turned 20 years, he spent his 19th and 20th birthday behind bars, an American citizen. What on earth, is going on in Franklin County?
Elizabeth, I can tell this is, as a matter of fact, it has gotten me infuriated just by hearing what you're saying, that something like this is going on in the United States in the 21st century, and what you're saying is probably going on in a bunch of states in this country right now. Because as I have been quoting all day, these people rather serve in hell than serve in heaven. And your son, he was there in this particular, you said it was a cul-de-sac. What was he doing there?
He was with his friends. This was a very good friend of his. My son was sleeping out. There was a truck to the left of the house. My son was sleeping in that truck. The family was sleeping in the house. When this woman came running and screaming, because my son got to her first, and then the other family members came out. His friend came out of the house and his friend's grandma also. Everybody was in shock. You know, everybody was in shock. They were all trying to see, you know, what happens next. My son stayed with the woman. He made sure she got the help she needed. In fact, my son is the one who went, when the police were coming and they couldn't find the house, my son went and met the police and brought them to where the woman was. And he's the one that actually physically brought the police officer to where the woman was to make sure she gets help in the most expedient way possible. He actually stayed there. He did not go back or go anywhere else. He stayed there until the lady was ambulanced away. He was actually there the rest of that day because they had a late night. He was there the rest of that day. He did not try and go anywhere else. I've never heard. Somehow he's supposed to have shot this woman in the face, taken the money, been in the car, packed in enough for her, him to be there when she gets out of the car, comes out screaming, all this in the space of a minute and 30 seconds, you know?
And she went directly to the person to try to kill her for help.
It makes no earthly sense. She has been told, I do not know where, but this just shows the amount of corruption there is in the assistant district attorney's office. The victim was told by the assistant district attorney that I am not Shannon's mother, that Shannon is from a royal family in Africa who is footing the bill. So, you know, ordinarily, you know, that now you need to just, you know, change your story so you can benefit from the lawsuit if you sue them on the civil side. You know, that is the extent this district attorney's office will go. She has called my son a vagabond in open court. You know, this is, I'm like, why on earth is this particular district attorney trying to besmirch Shannon's character before the judge without a trial? They will not bring my son into any courtroom. They won't bring him out of the jailhouse. We've had 2 dates calendared. They will not produce my son in front of a judge, period. They won't even let him out of the jailhouse on his court days. I thought he left these things in the third world.
Well, can't the judge, David, maybe that's something I should have asked Matt, was going to call, can't the judge demand the presence of that person in the courtroom?
Well, the problem is that his attorney, who's taken $50,000 from the family as a retainer for the young
defense. Tell us about that.
He's not doing anything for the kid. That's his attorney's job, to get in front of that judge and say, listen, produce this man. You know, the mother had to produce the habeas, you know, which was a legal right. They denied it, but the mother had to do it. Mike Klinkumson, okay, who's the attorney that took $50,000 from his family to represent this young man, hasn't done anything. And that's his job, to go before the court and say, hey, listen, you know, this guy's been locked up for over a year.
Why wasn't that money used for the bond? Why didn't the lawyer use the money for the bond?
We didn't have a choice. I did not have a choice in Mr. Klinkerson being Shannon's attorney. This is a man
you didn't have
that
a choice.
No, I did not. It was Mr. Klinkerson used devious methods to have himself put in as Shannon's attorney. He took money from my sister. Not from me. He took money from my sister and then went and told Shannon. He took money on the Friday, or maybe the Friday, I think, because I found out on Friday afternoon from my sister, and then went and told Shannon on Sunday, if you sign this paperwork that will confirm me as your attorney, I will have you out by Monday. And my poor son called me after he'd signed that paperwork. He didn't know. He came and told me after he signed that paperwork that, Mama, this guy says he'll have me out of jail by Monday afternoon at the latest.
Okay, so do you have a copy of the paperwork that he signed?
No, sir, I don't have a copy of the paperwork. It's a contract that Mr. Clinton has.
Okay, but the thing is, though, as the mother, can't you get this paperwork from? What does he say about the paperwork if you ask for it?
Mr. Kukasum has me thrown out of the office any time I try and show up and question anything about my son. He has me thrown out. He's instructed everybody not to talk to me. He has refused to return any calls. My son Shannon has instructed him in writing that if he's unable to provide an effective defense for my son, unable or unwilling, that he must give me a call and let me know. Mr. Klinkerson still has not done that. So he not only he's a thief, but he's a worm in the soil that needs to be squished. That is how dirty this person is.
Well, this is what I want to understand here. Your sister gave him the money. Will he speak to your sister?
I have no idea. My main concern now is Shannon's health and well-being. Klinkerson, I have put in my report to the bar, North Carolina bar, and they're going to get the wheels turning in whatever form they have, whatever their mode of operation is, but my concern now is my son's life. You know, $50,000 compared to my son's life, I would rather have my son.
Yes. Absolutely true. What are we going to, or what we, what, well, I know what I'm going to do. What is, David, what is your next step in your blog? You have done an amazing and yeoman's job on this, and I am going to work with you to have some of this posted on my website, the information that you've dug up about this trial. And there seems to be, tell us a little bit about the signatures where the judge was supposed to sign, and then you look at the judge's signature, and it doesn't quite look the same.
Yeah, that's why I was saying earlier, you know, that this case had some problems early on. Number one, when on February 20th of 2013, when Judge Height allegedly granted a motion and ordered that the case be taken off of the docket, I thought that was very incredulous for two reasons. Number one, a judge typically doesn't give a prosecutor that much discretion, especially when you're considering a person's right to due process and speedy trial. Okay.
Right.
The order actually says, you know, until such time that the state's attorney puts it back on, and it says that the defense counsel agreed with it. That was crazy. So we began to investigate that, and if you look at that form, it's on the blog. It looks like a pre-printed form, and it's got handwriting on it. Okay, so typically you don't see an order from a judge with that kind of composition format where you have printing and handwriting, okay? Mm-hmm. So that caused me to look at all the other documents. And then I noticed that there were handwriting on the affidavit for the search warrant, which they used to get the DNA swabs from the gentleman, and the two handwritings match. You know, they're identical. And that's bizarre because the two documents come from two separate judges' chambers. Judge Height sent out the motion the motion to order the case taken off the docket, and it was actually Judge Donald W. Stevens who signed the search warrant. So how can you have the same handwriting? Do they have the same administrative assistant or the same secretary?
Well, that was the next question I was going to ask you.
I was really concerned about that, you know, and you look at that, it's clearly the same handwriting. And then the affidavit is strange because the DWS initial isn't accompanied by, you know, the date that it was put on there. Typically, if you work in any kind
you
of business.
You sign it, date it. Right.
You sign it and date it. Okay. The date's not there, so anybody could have put that initial on there. You know, after it was filed at the county clerk's office. But more importantly, why would the judge enter that addendum? Do you know how inappropriate, you know, unethical, improper that is?
Right.
Can these judges be contacted?
We're going to be doing that very shortly. The question I wanted to ask you, David, is that isn't when that sign – doesn't that have to be time-stamped?
Yes, it does. It does have to be time-stamped.
There was no time-stamp on that that I saw. Did I miss it?
No, there's no time-stamp on it. Then there's a time-stamp on the front part of the affidavit when it was actually filed in the county clerk's office. But at some point, someone said, wait a minute, we need to put this in here, okay? And when you do that, you want to do that before official of the court because it's an official court document. Okay, and then not only that, Lieutenant Little was the guy who sought the search warrant. Why didn't he put it on there? And then you mean to tell me that if the kid confessed, which is the most compelling, you know, culpable evidence that you can have against him, he forgot to put that in? You know, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. That's how you know that something's really, really funky going on here. And I believe, and I'm going to go on record and say that I believe that the assistant attorney, okay, assistant district attorney, Annette Sellers, okay, who more than likely is handwriting on the judge's order to take the case off the docket, is this person who put that handwritten addendum on there.
That's Annette Sellers, huh?
That's correct. The assistant district attorney, Annette Sellers.
How many district assistant DAs do they have down there? Franklin County. Can't have but a couple.
Yeah, it's like I think they only have two. They have Annette Sellers, but they all work in different districts. Okay,
yeah.
For Franklin County, I think she's the only one that's working out of that office with Sam Curran. Okay, so Sam Curran didn't even know about that particular motion when Ms. Cruder presented it to him. Okay, and he kept saying, "Why was this exceptional? Why is this exceptional?" You know, because they ruled the case exceptional and took it off the docket. But a judge can't take a case like that off the docket without, you know, establishing some kind of timetable when it's going to be prosecuted again. And
I refuse
to believe that a guy like Judge Height has reached this level of you know, this capacity as a judge in public service and not know that you have to establish a timetable. You know, that's what makes that order even more suspicious.
So we have three judges that are involved. Judge Height, Judge Hobgood and Johnson. Right. Now, Judge Height is the one who saw it originally?
Yes, he's the one that ordered the case off to be taken off of the docket until the state's attorney put it back on.
Is that H-E-I-G-H-T?
That's H-I-G-H-T.
Oh, H-I-G-H-T. Okay. Okay. Well, you know, he is almost being put in the same situation as a terrorist would be put in the same situation. I mean, have they said anything? Why is he a threat to blow up the police quarters of Franklin County or the state of North Carolina? Why so much scrutiny?
Yeah, why restricted visitation? Why restricted access to this kid at all? I don't get any of that.
Yeah, well, the explanation that the mother was given was that there were a volume of violent criminals who had recently entered the Franklin County Detention Center, and they were putting him in segregation or administrative seg, okay, for his own protection. All right, that's the story they was giving the mother. But I'm a former correctional officer, okay, and I know what that kind of confinement can do to a person, all right, especially a young man who hasn't any prior history with the law. He has had no brushes with the law. He doesn't know anything about the penal system whatsoever. You're locked in your cell 23 hours, and you're only allowed out 1 hour a day for recreation or to have your meal or what have you. And it's designed, as the mother stated earlier, to break him down, okay, to beat him down, to get him to accept the deal. Now, I didn't mention this to you earlier, Michael, but the prosecutor has even been to the Franklin County Detention Center to solicit a plea deal from this kid without the presence of his attorney. And that, I believe, shows desperation on their part to try to get this kid to cop to a plea.
Because they'll make it all go away. Well,
he's
18, 19 now. So
he's 20 now. He turned 20 yesterday.
Oh, he's 20. Two days ago. So that means they could do whatever they want without his family or mother present. He don't need a guardian or anything else. But the DA going to see any criminal without the lawyer present is illegal.
Yeah, it is.
You can't.
If Mike Clickerson was aware of that and allowed the DA to go and speak to this kid without the kid's consent, he can actually brought up on sanctions against in front of the bar. I mean, that's totally
Mike
improper.
Clickerson? Who is Mike?
Yeah, Michael Clickerson.
How do you spell his name?
K L I K O S U M.
And what is he?
That's the guy that Shannon's aunt hired.
Oh,
as
that's
his
the
attorney.
Lawyer for Shannon. Right.
That's
Shannon's
correct.
Lawyer. Okay, and the question I have, it was $50,000 bond. Why was that bond posted to a bondsman?
Well, again, you know, it was some underhanded tactics. The lawyer situation is a whole separate story, okay?
Right.
Because they told the guy, you know, when it became obvious that he probably wasn't going to be a good fit for Shannon, they told him that they didn't want him. He manipulated the sister to get the money, and then went to the jail and told Channing that if you sign this, I'll get you out. And he did that on a weekend before they had the chance to get access to him to tell him don't sign anything. Okay,
okay,
so
you're
saying that so Shannon, he signed it but didn't read it? I guess.
Well, he signed it based on what the guy was saying to him. Yes, correct. Because the guy promised to get him out by Monday, and it was on Sunday.
Right.
So he promised to get him out the next day.
Okay. So, Michael, given all of this, what is the best way forward? Is it to go to the Attorney General of the state? Is it to go back to this county? Is it to go to the judges and get them to see the error of their ways? What's the corrective?
I think we first need to go and see this DA, Curran, to find out what his disposition is on this. Because, you know, you got a one-horse town, two DAs. I mean, how can you not know what's going on?
Well, Michael, actually, the case has already been brought, reported to the FBI. A criminal complaint has been filed, against the FBI. I think the best course of action is to have the Attorney General for the state to contact the State Bureau of Investigations and to have them to launch an investigation because of, you know, the very peculiar circumstances with the paperwork, the lack of evidence that you would find in a case of this magnitude. You're talking about a guy who shot somebody in the face, okay?
Yeah.
DNA was taken from him compared to DNA at the scene. Fingerprints were taken. So you have evidentiary elements that could be, you know, utilized to say, hey, this kid did it. But it's not present in the file, okay? All this missing paperwork, there's something going on. So I think there needs to be an investigation by the State Bureau of Investigations down there. And the person who can make sure that happened would definitely be the Attorney General.
Attorney General, right. The Attorney General – see, the Attorney General here in this state is a Democrat, and the governor is a Republican, regressive party member who don't care about Jack. So now, the next question I want to ask you, do they know who did this crime? Do you know, David?
Well, there are a volume of people in the community who say that there are the two kids who did it were two white kids that allegedly related to the sheriff, Jerry Jones. You know, Michael, you can go down there and talk to the people in the neighborhood. They'll tell you. Okay, these two kids allegedly have been committing a volume of crimes down there, robberies, and I think there was a shooting incident where people were saying that one of the kids did it. All right? So everybody down there knows who did it. You know, you saw the pictures that I posted on the blog of the kid with all the money the very next day after the crime.
Also, wearing
clothing items that match the description of what people told the cops of the gentleman they saw running away. So that's why I'm saying there has to be an investigation into this by the State Bureau of Investigations.
Well, you know, the question I have, because we had to tie this up here, but is this thing about him being a royal prince, does everybody think they're going to get money out of this and they're going to hold him for ransom and then everybody's going to get a split of all the money? Is that even in the realm of possibility?
Well, see, you know, like I said on the blog, we don't know what Franklin County Sheriff's Office or either State Bureau of Investigations found when they searched this lady's home. Now, her home was very familiar to the police because she's got several kids that have brushes with the law. Okay, so we don't know what they found in there. And I wouldn't doubt if Annette Sellers or somebody in the DA's office put pressure on this woman to change her story, because obviously from what she told the cops, the primary officers, she didn't even know who assaulted her or who shot her. Okay, for her now to change her story and to come up with this bogus story about the boy's family being part of a royal family, I believe that Annette Sellers told her that. Okay, you know, to make her think that she could, you know, capitalize off of this if Shannon got convicted.
This has been outrageous. Elizabeth, I am so sorry. You're working closely with David. I'm very glad. And we're going to get on this. I'm going to see who I can speak to. I'm going to next week. This week was such a mess because of the snow and everything. But next week we're going to call the Attorney General's office. And I'm going to see what Mr. Cooper's people say about this. And has the SBI already done or starting to do an investigation?
Well, they advised Ms. Crudup on yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, that if Sam Curran gave them a call, you know, with that in mind, they would, in fact, launch one. Okay?
Okay.
So that's why I said, but she's already been to Sam Curran. Okay? And nothing's been done. It's Sons Langley. That's why I'm saying we need to go to the to Roy Cooper's office, the state attorney general.
You're right. Mm-hmm. Is there also, just to ask, has there been any establishment of a legal defense fund or anything that people can donate to or help with?
Yeah, on his site, that his mother put up, there is a campaign where people can actually buy a T-shirt to support to his legal fund.
Okay.
Well, the next question I have is, how can you have a fund if nobody's been charged with anything?
That's what makes this case a human rights case, okay? Because this man's being held with no pending criminal charges.
No charges. Being held in Guantanamo, Franklin County, and we no one can even see him.
Well, his mother mother's been denied. I don't know about if you go down there, Mike, you might be able to see him, but I know they've been keeping his mom from him.
How, I mean, how's that even legal?
Yeah, it is illegal. If other detainees are being afforded that privilege and Shannon hasn't broke any of the prison or the institution's violations, you know, that's unfair itself.
Right.
You know, he should be given the same privileges as anyone else.
Right, absolutely. Well, I want to say, Elizabeth, thank you for coming on, and we're going to see what we can do. I understand the National Action Network, Rosa Garvin, is going to be involved in this also. And just hang in there, Elizabeth, and we're going to see what we can push. What side will come out squeaking? And you know, when I saw you, Elizabeth, at the State Executive Committee meeting, I was interviewing a lot of people for the show who were running for office and whatnot, and there was a lot of other people who just wanted to get on the air to say hi, and they weren't doing anything, and I did not take you serious at all. I did keep your flyer. We need to talk about an injustice. And I looked at this when I came home, and I said, I wonder what this is all about. And when I read further, it said, held hostage. I said, oh, no, this can't be. And I was trying to picture who gave it to me, and then I remember you. You were busy trying to get it out, and you were running by, and I said, oh, I'll take one. And you said, please, please, my son, it's injustice. And I just kept it. And it was in my jacket pocket. That's where I put it. And I thought about this all that Saturday night when I went to church after I came home from church. I said, we need to do something about this. So I'm very glad that David is with you, and I am with you, and I hope all the listeners are out there, and any listeners out there that want to see what's going on. I mean, there's D.A. Sam Curran in Franklin County you can call. There's also Mike Klinkle. How do you pronounce his name, the lawyer? David?
Klinkleson.
Klinkleson. He's the lawyer for Shannon, supposedly the lawyer for Shannon. And then there's Judge Height, Judge Hobgood, and Judge Johnson. All these people need to be aware that everybody is starting to look at this. And he is not going to be forgotten. Shannon is not going to be someone who is going to be put away, corner, and forgotten. He is not going to be forgotten. So, and I'd just like to thank both of you, David and Elizabeth, for coming on. And
hey, Mike.
I need to have, David, I need to have you, what's your website? So people can
people can read about Shannon, the case of Shannon Imhotep, at thepeopleschampion.me. That's thepeopleschampion.me.
And if they wanted to talk to you, is there a number they can get a hold of you, or how they get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can reach me at area code 410-908-7378.
Very good. And Elizabeth, just hang in there. We're hoping we can get the Calvary up and moving.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Please, everyone, go read the blog. Go read the blog. It has more information than we've been able to cover. And
yes.
So I'm encouraging everyone, go read the peopleschampion.me and stand him in your prayers, because God is moving for him. If there's anything anyone can do, please do it. Phone call, letter to Shannon, anything.
Okay. David, I'd like to have an update next week.
No problem.
From you. Okay.
No problem.
And Elizabeth, I'd like to have an update from you next week also. We're going to talk about this thing on every show. We will talk about this and let the people aware what it, the injustice that's going on. I want to thank both of you for being guests on the show today.
All right, Michael. Always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you. And Elizabeth, same thing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thomas, so what
it
do you think?
So it's just unbelievable. It just it breaks my heart. I'm sitting here as a parent listening to this lady, and I cannot fathom the pain and the agony that she's going through. I can't believe that. I mean, they won't even let her see him. It's just it's unbelievable. It's such a terrible injustice. I do hope that we bring public pressure and shine the spotlight in Franklin County, where obviously it needs to be shined, and expose all these cockroaches and root this out. Because if not, it's going to happen to someone else's child.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's probably happening to someone else's child right now. Okay,
probably
ladies and gentlemen, we got to go. That's the end of the show. Keep Shannon in your prayers. And you can look at my website. That's Michael Lawson, the last word, .com. See you, everybody. This has been The Last Word with Michael Lawson and Thomas Forsberg. All right, Thomas, have a good weekend.
Take care, sir.
Thank you.